Coming up next, Upstate's HealthLink on air. On tonight's program, can exercise stave off Alzheimer's disease?
Now, we're not completely sure of how exercise helps. We just know that it does. Good exercise actually helps regenerate the neurons.
Plus, the causes and treatments for depression.
The majority of people in this country who develop major depression probably never get appropriate professional care for it. Certainly, there's still a great deal of shame and misunderstanding surrounding psychiatric disorders in general and depression in particular.
And a look at a new program to help diversify the pool of health professionals.
It's also having students and practitioners and providers from similar backgrounds in the healthcare industry.
We'll get a checkup from the neck up and a new piece from our healing muse. And that's all coming up right after the news. This is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink on Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On tonight's show, with the spotlight turned on depression by the tragic death of comedian Robin Williams, we take a closer look at this disease and how it can be successfully treated today. Plus, how an Upstate initiative is helping to promote diversity among healthcare professionals. But first, how to stave off Alzheimer's disease with some daily exercise. Well, recent studies have suggested that being in good shape in your 40s may help lower your risk of Alzheimer's disease and other types of dementia in your senior years. And the better shape you're in, the lower the risk may be. Here with more on this is Dr. Dale Avers, Associate Professor of Physical Therapy Education in the College of Health Professions at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Dr. Avers.
Thanks
for coming
Linda.
In. So you can stave off Alzheimer's disease with exercise. Can you help us understand that?
Sure. You know, the brain is an organ just like all the rest of our organs, and they depend on blood supply. And so anything that we can do to keep our blood vessels healthy is excellent, and we know that exercise is probably the number one way that we can do that.
So while we don't exactly know what causes Alzheimer's per se, or even some types of dementia, what's the relationship, though, in terms of keeping your blood vessels healthy and a healthy brain, or exercise in a healthy brain? How does that work?
Interesting. The brain is a bit of a blood hog in that it requires about 25% of every heartbeat as far as the amount of blood that the brain needs to stay healthy. So certainly if you have reduced cholesterol, you have your lumens, the inside of your blood vessels are clean and wide as they were when you were younger, it's going to help the amount of blood that gets to the brain.
So basically you're oxygenating or getting healthy blood flow to the vessels of the brain, keeping the brain younger, keeping it able to generate new cell growth?
Absolutely.
Is that part of
it? And I think that's the next part. So, we're not completely sure of how exercise helps. We just know that it does. So the theory of getting blood to the brain is one theory. And then the other part is that the cells and the neurochemicals that are in the brain require good blood supply. And once upon a time, we thought that the neurons were, once you lost them, which happens with age, you were just deficit in that. Now we know that good exercise actually helps regenerate the neurons. And so our brains are what we call plastic in that they're able to be regenerated and actually can offset any of the normal aging changes through stimulation.
That's really a stunning finding, in a sense, because in my earlier life, I studied brain development, and it was told that there was a certain amount of neuroplasticity, is what you're talking about, in children, clearly, as they grew, especially with language development, only till about age 13.
Yeah.
And now what you're saying is that the brain throughout our lives can continue to grow and improve in a sense.
Isn't that marvelous?
Yeah, that's very hopeful.
It's very exciting.
Information.
What we've found is mostly through the studies of stroke, so that when somebody has a stroke and that part of the brain has died, that we can train other parts of the brain to carry on. But that requires a very specific kind of activity. And I dare say that that will help your brain health as well.
You know, when we talk about exercise, though, let's be a little bit more specific. How much is enough? I mean, this has been a subject of some controversy. Mm-hmm. And there's even been talk that you can exercise too much. So help us understand that.
Well, I think it's pretty irrefutable now that 150 minutes of moderate intense exercise per week is really the minimum in order to get the health benefits that exercise can provide. But
let me stop you there for 1 second. When you say 150 minutes of moderate
intense,
can you explain what that means?
Slightly breathless, so that you're working hard. But you can get that in almost any way. You can get it for 10 minutes at a time. We used to think that you had to exercise for 20 or 30 minutes and get your heart rate up. But now we know that anything helps as long as you're stimulating your body to work hard. And that's really what it needs. So this 150 minutes can be gotten in any way. Walking is probably one of the most perfect exercises, but climbing stairs, going to the gym, running, biking, anything that's going to cause some strenuous work on your part.
So you don't have to run marathons anymore.
Absolutely
to be
not.
In quote-unquote good shape.
Right.
But you do have to remain active.
Absolutely, yes.
So what's the distinction between exercise and being active?
Great question. I think exercise is structured and activity is part of what you do every day. And what's great now is that we know that just stair climbing as part of activity through your everyday routine is wonderful at helping you stay in shape. So instead of avoiding stairs, you should look for the stairs. And there's actually a movement among architects to make stairs more prominent so that you have to go looking for the elevator instead of going to look for the stairs.
That's a novel idea.
Wouldn't it be? Yes.
Yeah, especially in the States with so many more people becoming sedentary and the issue of obesity.
Right.
If we could develop more of that concept or the culture where we would encourage that kind of activity.
That's right. That's right. Yes.
So bottom line is there kind of a cutoff? For example, if you exercise fewer than 3 times a week versus more than 3 times a week, does that dramatically impact from these studies the potential for developing Alzheimer's or other dementias?
I think 150 minutes is a good target. The range is 150 to 300 minutes a week. Pretty much over 300, you're not going to get near the health benefits. I mean, it's certainly going to help reserve that ability, that kind of extra, so that when problems happen, and they do as we age, you have something that's going to restore you quicker. And I think that's the major key of starting this younger, is to build that reserve so that when bad luck happens, you have some cushion, so to speak.
Yeah, I read somewhere 50% of people over age 85 have some kind of dementia.
Mm-hmm. Especially women.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with physical therapy education professor Dr. Dale Avers. We're talking about staving off Alzheimer's and other dementias with exercise. So let's get more specific in terms of, we just talked about physical exercise. How about mental stimulation? This is obviously something that's always been talked about when it comes to memory issues, memory loss, that kind of thing. What kinds of things are important to be doing, and how early should we be doing any of these things?
Great question about how early. I know the literature says between 40 and 60 are the critical years to build this reserve and to teach yourself healthy habits. But we know that TV watching can be really detrimental to your mental health. So anything in excess of 4 hours per day, it tends to have negative consequences on brain health and your stimulation.
And that's something to remember even in terms of our children
absolutely.
As they develop.
That's right. Because it's so
passivity.
Passive.
Yeah.
It's so passive. Now, I have not seen the studies about computer games, and depending on how passive, I know there are computer games that really require a lot of thinking, but for instance, I like to mellow out with solitaire, and that's a pretty passive kind of activity, so that's not going to help me, and in fact, if I do it excessively, that will be detrimental to my mental health.
Mm.
But other things, like anything that's new and stimulating, so if you like Sudoku, but you're only working on easy puzzles, then that's probably not going to be as stimulating as challenging yourself to do the hard ones once in a while, or learning a new skill like crocheting or piano playing.
Or a new language, perhaps.
Or a new language, or getting into debates and thinking, pushing yourself to get new information and thinking about it in different ways. That's what it takes.
It seems like there's a larger message here that if things become too easy, whether it be a physical exercise or a mental exercise of some kind or any kind of interaction, if they become too easy, that becomes a problem. Mm-hmm. That you need to continually, on some level, challenge us ourselves physically as well as mentally.
Exactly, Linda. I think the word hard is the new four-letter word, the negative, that things need to be hard rather than easy. And as we age, people often look for the easy way.
So, well, I think people have the sense that they've worked hard for many, many, many years of their lives.
That's right.
Excuse me. And therefore, they think, this is my time to take it easy.
Right.
But in fact, that works against you.
Exactly. So I'd like to have people think of easy as the four-letter word and hard as a good thing, and to work hard. You don't have to do it all the time, but you need to work hard every day for short periods of time.
I think that's
the key. And think hard, too. Yeah.
So how does diet play a role in all of this?
Mm-hmm.
Because that's also the third leg of the stool, I think.
Right. I think there's two ways. One is having a good Mediterranean diet with a lot of olive oil. And then it's the omega-3 fatty acids that are so good, the things that you get from fish such as salmon or tuna. And that tends to help the infrastructure of the brain restore itself and to keep it in good tune, if you will. So we know that people with Alzheimer's have lower DHA levels, which comes from those omega-3 fatty acids.
So the idea being that if you have a diet rich in those things, even starting quite early throughout your life, there's some kind of a protective quality that is generated.
Yes, that's exactly right.
So basically there's a message here that sounds to me like start young, stay active, or involve yourself in some degree of activity, mental and physical.
Mm-hmm.
Eat something like a Mediterranean, well-balanced fruits, nuts, grains, and low in fat diet. I guess the question is, as people age and they perhaps think it's time for them to take it easy, but also other things intervene, like they may develop some degree of physical disability. Perhaps they lose some hearing, they lose some ability to see, issues with physical mobility.
Mm-hmm.
How can you, or what do you recommend to people to be able to stay active, to do things that are hard, even though they have some limitations?
Exactly. I think we have to guard ourselves against the all or nothing so that you do something. And that may mean very short kinds of walks, getting up off the couch frequently, and mental stimulation. So as an example, my father is quite physically disabled, but he stays very mentally stimulated by listening to opera and interpreting that and reading and challenging himself to debates and current events. And therefore, even though he's confined to a wheelchair, mentally he's really quite good. And so I think that's the important thing, is to make sure that we still push ourselves, even if we can't physically so much, mentally for sure.
There actually is data to support that those types of activities started at an earlier age really, really can make a difference.
Yes,
so
they do.
What, if you were to round it, kind of sum it all up, what do you tell your patients?
That you need to do something hard every day, be it mental and physical, to challenge yourself and to get that regular physical activity. So figure out a way that you can push yourself a little bit, even if it's just climbing stairs instead of confining yourself to one floor.
Or park further away. What are some other practical things?
Oh, that's so true, is to park in the back of the parking lot and kind of try to push yourself to walk faster. We know that people who walk faster are actually in better health, both mentally as well as physically. So it's something as simple as that, not letting yourself slow down too much. Maybe just because your friends are. Try to outpace them a bit. And again, it's pushing yourself.
Well,
I think it's incredibly good advice, and I want to thank you so very much for coming in. My guest has been Dr. Dale Aver. She's Associate Professor of Physical Therapy Education at Upstate's College of Health Professions for Upstate Medical University. Thanks again for coming in. Coming up next, the causes and treatments for depression. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen here with you. The tragic death of Robin Williams has once again taught us a painful lesson. Depression does not discriminate. Whether you're rich or poor, old or young, male or female, famous or not, you can have depression with the potential for severe consequences and even death. Joining us by phone with more on this is Dr. Ronald Pies. He's a professor of psychiatry at Upstate Medical University and Tufts University School of Medicine in Boston. And he's also the editor-in-chief emeritus of the Psychiatric Times. Welcome, Dr. Pies. Thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you, Linda.
You know, recently you were in the studio, and we talked on this show about the difference between grief and depression, as well as some other very interesting positions and ideas you have about the status of psychiatry today. It was a very illuminating discussion.
I enjoyed it. Thank you.
So help us once again to understand for our listeners what constitutes clinical depression as a true medical condition, and how is it different from simply feeling down, sad, or even experiencing grief for that matter?
Right. Well, thanks, Linda. First of all, when we speak of clinical depression, we're usually talking about what psychiatrists and psychologists call a major depressive episode, MDE. Basically, that's a period of at least 2 weeks during which the person experiences a markedly depressed mood or loss of interest or pleasure in most activities. And then, by our usual criteria, the person has to have at least 4 other symptoms like insomnia, loss of appetite, decreased energy, decreased concentration, feelings of low self-esteem, and there are other symptoms that the person can get. Keep in mind that a major depressive episode is not a specific disease. It's sort of a building block for either of 2 kinds of mood disorder. There's major depressive disorder, which we sometimes call unipolar major depression. So that's MDD, major depressive disorder. And then there's bipolar disorder. And to simplify things just a bit, I'd like to focus our discussion more on unipolar major depression. Bipolar is kind of a whole other kettle of fish. So basically, major depressive disorder, MDD, is a medical condition in at least 2 senses. First, like any other form of medical illness or disease, major depressive disorder results in a good deal of suffering, incapacity, and often vocational disability. In fact, Harvard University and the World Health Organization concluded that over the next 20 years, unipolar depression is likely to be the second leading cause of disability worldwide and the leading cause of disability in high-income countries like the United States. Secondly, major depressive disorder is associated with an increased risk for other medical illnesses like cardiovascular disorders and diabetes. And of course, as the tragic outcome with Robin Williams shows, major depressive disorder also brings with it the risk of suicide in as many as 4% of those afflicted.
And so how, in your mind, can someone make the distinction, either in a loved one or in themselves, for that matter, of the difference between having a major depressive disorder and then, or just maybe grieving the loss of someone in their life, or just feeling down periodically?
Yeah, that's a great question. In our last discussion, I mentioned how in ordinary grief or sadness, self-esteem is usually preserved. That is not the case in major depression. The person feels terribly unworthy and not deserving of life. Also, when people are normally grieving, they usually respond to consolation from friends or family. People with major depressive disorder usually are not consolable. They are just constantly down and depressed, tearful, agitated. I also mentioned in our last discussion that the person with ordinary sadness is usually able to carry on with responsibilities at work and at home, whereas the person with major depression is severely impaired in those functions. But, you know, I think the best description of severe depression and how different it is from sadness was provided recently by Dr. Kay Jamison in a piece that just appeared in the New York Times. She is a psychologist who has suffered from bipolar disorder for many years, but what she says really applies to severe major depression of any kind. And I'll just read 30 seconds here on what she said, if that's okay.
Sure, go ahead.
She said, and I'm quoting, "Suicidal depression is a state of cold, agitated horror and relentless despair. The things that you most love in life leech away. Everything is an effort all day and throughout the night. There is no hope, no point, no nothing. The burden you know yourself to be to others is intolerable." End of quote.
Wow.
Yeah, I think anyone listening who has had severe depression knows what Dr. Jamison is describing. We're not talking about a bad hair day. We're really talking about a serious and potentially lethal disorder.
And I read somewhere that as many as 1 in 6 people in the United States, or approximately 17.5 million Americans, suffer from depression
right.
in this country. So it's not a small number who are experiencing this.
No, not at all. Usually we express the frequency in terms of prevalence, and that's basically new cases plus any existing cases in a period of time. So in the United States, the yearly prevalence of major depressive disorder in those 18 or over is around 7% of the adult population. About 16 million people, or roughly 1 in 14 adults in this country. So we're talking just about adults here. If you add in adolescents age 12 to 17, that's an additional 2 million or so Americans a year. So, yeah, about 18 million Americans a year will report a major depressive episode. That's a lot of people.
Really is. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with psychiatrist Dr. Ronald Pies, and we're talking about depression. I don't want to run out of time, Dr. Pies. I have two big subjects I want to cover. First, I want to get to both. One is, what are the causes, as you see them, that leads someone to a depression? And, you know, how much is it family history, genetics, that kind of thing? And then I want to talk about treatment and successful treatment. So let's get to the first. Who's most at risk for clinical depression? What are some of the complex issues that contribute?
Right. Well, generally, we think that this is a biological, psychological, and social condition. You know, we don't believe, as some people claim, that everything is a chemical imbalance. That's really sort of nonsense. Although abnormal biochemical changes in the brain often do accompany depression. In terms of risk factors, it seems, at least for unipolar depression, that women are more susceptible than men during their lifetime, and that's a whole complicated issue we probably won't have time to talk about. Risk factors also include things like separation or divorce, the presence of a major medical illness, particularly stroke or certain endocrine disorders. And there are cultural factors that are involved, too. Not surprisingly, poverty increases the risk of depression. And I'll also mention the postpartum period, where the woman who just gave birth can become significantly depressed in about 10% or so of cases.
But we do know now that it's treatable.
Yes.
So the question is, how is it treated most successfully these days? I mean, obviously, talk therapy has always played some role, and in recent years, pharmacologic agents have played an increasing
right.
role. Where do you see the best success?
Well, most mild to moderate cases of major depressive disorder will respond to talk therapy alone. That's the good news. Bad news is it's often very hard for people to get that, and decreased access, insurance problems, and so on often make it hard for folks to get psychotherapy. More severe depression often requires medication, and some studies say that the most effective treatment is actually a combination of psychotherapy and medication, which probably work on different aspects of the depression. And in very, very severe or resistant cases, or when psychosis is present, sometimes ECT or electroconvulsive therapy is used and can be very effective.
So there really is hope.
There really is hope. We often find that people will achieve a complete remission from their episode, and some folks never go on to have another one. Unfortunately, major depression does tend to be recurrent, and so we don't usually talk about a cure, but we do have good treatments for it.
I also read a very shocking statistic that only 50% of people who are diagnosed with major depression receive any kind of treatment, and many don't even receive treatment that's consistent with current practices. And even people who have attempted suicide don't even report that they've perceived the need for care. Why do you think that is?
Well, you're absolutely right. The majority of people in this country who develop major depression probably never get appropriate professional care for it, and there are a lot of reasons. Certainly, there's still a great deal of shame and misunderstanding surrounding psychiatric disorders in general, and depression in particular. Many people see depression as a character flaw or as a sign of weakness. They think that the person's just feeling sorry for herself and that they should pick themselves up by their bootstraps. They don't realize that having major depression is like being without boots or even without feet.
Mm.
So these are all problems that make it difficult for some people to seek help. And often, even when they get to their general practitioner, family practitioner, the depression is not diagnosed. And so we have a long ways to go in educating both our colleagues and the public about these issues.
Yeah, and the stigma seems to remain. Regardless of all of the attempts at public education, there is a very strong stigma attached to mental illness.
There is. I think it's getting a little better over the years. I think we've seen some improvement, but even today, there is still a great deal of misunderstanding.
In the little bit of time we have left, what would you recommend to someone as to how to help a family friend or family member or a friend who has someone who says they are depressed, especially in light of this whole idea of potential for suicide?
Right. Good question. Well, first off, what should you not do? First of all, don't assume that the person is just kidding around. People often say that, particularly if he or she is talking about ending her life or being tired of living and so on. You should always take that seriously. Not slough it off. If you're afraid the person is actually considering suicide, ask about it. There's a myth out that if you ask about it, you'll put the idea in the person's head. Well, that's not the case. Usually the person feels relieved that someone has finally asked. And if it's clear that the depressed friend or family member is seriously depressed and not functioning, offer to hear them out, let them talk about what's bothering them, but don't try to be their therapist. Help them get in touch with their family doctor or their GP so they can be evaluated. Sometimes what looks like a major depressive episode can turn out to be due to some endocrine or neurological condition, and so a good medical workup is always in order. Then the family doctor can refer the patient for specialized care or work in consultation with a mental health professional.
Well, this has been so enlightening, and there's so much more we could probably talk
mm-hmm.
about, but sadly I've run out of time. But I want to thank you so much for coming, for being
sure.
willing to chat with us. My guest has been Dr. Ronald Pies. He's a professor of psychiatry at Upstate Medical University and Tufts University School of Medicine in Boston, and he's the editor-in-chief emeritus of the Psychiatric Times. Once again, thanks so much, Dr. Pies.
My pleasure.
I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
Hi, I'm psychologist Dr. Rich O'Neill with this week's checkup from the neck up, the good morning experiment, or moments of connection. So, folks, you know how our president reviews things every year in the State of the Union address? Well, when the mood strikes, I do a State of the Rich O'Neill to see what in my life needs tweaking or trashing. What did I find out recently? Category one is still above ground and likely to be so for some time. If we don't count the slight ringing in the ears, glass contraptions in front of the eyes, toenails that chorus, "Fungus is among us," and don't count the repeated discovery that smiling young women now sashay over to whisper breathlessly that they went to high school with one of my sons and is he still around? Ouch, yes, especially if we try to forget that. I'm galloping through middle age relatively unscathed physically, if not psychologically. So check. Category two, family. Wife Pammy and I are alarmingly happy. Both sons finished college, working, not calling enough, but what's new? My 97-year-old mom with Alzheimer's, still loving me and me her, but with hugs, kisses, and quiet walks because talking doesn't work anymore. Sad? But overall, check, check, check. Job? Attaboy's slightly more frequent than what were you thinking, Noodle Noggin? Check. Money? Living within the paycheck, so say check. Friendships? Continue despite me being who I am. Check. Happy moments with other folks? Found I'd like more warm, cheery, fun moments in my days. So I've started what I call my good morning experiment. As I'm tootling around the universe, I'm saying a real good morning and making twinkly eye contact with most everybody, especially peeps I usually wouldn't. I found almost everybody says good morning back. And sometimes we go on for a few friendly sentences, and I feel brighter. Who knows? Maybe some of these cheery moments of connection will blossom and we'll gallop together, then commiserate when it's our turn in the nursing home, where my sons won't be the main attraction and the gal-to-guy ratio will be a reason to smile. I'm Dr. Rich, Twinkle Twinkle O'Neill. Good day, and thanks for tuning in.
A new initiative to promote diversity among healthcare professionals. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Welcome back to HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen with your Healthy Monday Minute for the week of September 1st. Ready, set, go bag. Emergencies can strike at any time. It's important to have a plan for you and your family to follow in the event of a natural disaster, disease outbreak, or other dangerous situation. When making your plan, keep in mind that your family members may not all be in the same location and cell phones may be out of service. This week, make an emergency go bag with the supplies listed on ready.gov. Discuss your family's plan and keep a copy of it at home and work so it's easily accessible in the event of an emergency. Have a healthy Monday and a healthy week. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. The U.S. Census projects that by 2050, the Hispanic and Asian populations will both triple. The black population will almost double, while the white population will remain relatively static. As the U.S. becomes more ethnically and racially diverse, there is a need for healthcare systems and providers that can reflect and respond to an increasingly heterogeneous patient base. We'll hear with more on this, and a new local effort to support this idea is Sharon Heward, the Associate Dean of Student and Multicultural Affairs at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Sharon. Thanks for coming in today.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
So knowing how to serve people with different values, different health beliefs, different cultural, you know, backgrounds, and different perspectives about health and wellness seems to me to be crucially important at this time with all these demographic changes taking place in the United States. Tell us more about that.
Sure, absolutely. So there's two sides of it. Obviously, there's training for all students and practitioners and so on about how to serve that population, but it's also having students and practitioners and providers from similar backgrounds in the healthcare industry. And that's really what we're looking for, and what many schools across the U.S. are looking for as far as training students from diverse backgrounds and being able to then put them, you know, into communities and patient populations where the patients can look back at someone that does look like them, that does represent them.
And the idea being that perhaps promotes what, like more trust perhaps, more compliance on the part of patients, that more understanding perhaps.
Absolutely. Yeah, making a connection, and also students from a rural background or an underrepresented background may be more likely to go back and serve the community where they came from and to be able to give back to that community.
So that's an added value.
Absolutely.
So from your standpoint, what have you seen in terms of why there is this underrepresentation of certain populations? I mean, is it poverty? Is it lack of access? What are the factors that play a role in that?
Sure, and actually it's both of those things. You know, I just heard a statistics that 2% of, you know, the highest 2% are the ones that tend to wind up being in medical school. So, you know, if you're not from the top, or if your parents aren't doctors, or if you don't have the ability to learn about health professions or health careers early on in life, if you don't have that guidance, you know, so certainly.
So access is
huge, but obviously, you know, students taking prep courses and various other things, you know, one school may be having their students go on one track and another school may be having their students go on another track. So certainly location, rural locations maybe aren't preparing their students as well or having that same drive that someone where the top, you know, top school, top high school sends their students to the top college, sends their students to the top medical school.
Yeah, so it's really, yeah, what you're saying or suggesting is that a lot of this tracking takes place very early in,
yeah,
someone's educational,
yeah,
history, and that even that type of tracking can prevent them from even considering,
sure,
or having the sense that they could be or imagine themselves in the role of a healthcare provider.
Absolutely.
At all levels.
Yeah, and that's where pipeline programs come in. They're starting as early as elementary school, and they're sending students that, you know, starting with the STEM programs, science and technology programs in elementary school, and helping those students get through that pipeline to middle school, to high school, to college, and so on, and eventually to come into a health career, hopefully.
So this initiative,
mm-hmm,
and I want to talk specifically,
yeah,
about this initiative that you're a part of here, is an effort to really kind of augment or open the door to or open the experience of healthcare professions to individuals who ordinarily might not have been exposed to that opportunity.
Absolutely, yes.
So tell us about it. What exactly is the program?
Yep.
And then how did it come to be?
Sure. So the program is called Try On a White Coat. And we are looking to reach out to students who have finished their first or second year of college who are in some sort of a pre-health program. They may have thought when they were 4 years old that they wanted to be a doctor, or they may have just somewhere along the line gotten into that pipeline where folks have said, hey, you're strong in science, you're strong in math, and now they're at college and they don't know what they want to do, but they're in some sort of a pre-health program. And we want to bring them here to Upstate for a week in an immersion, you know, have them for a week get to learn about all of our different health professions, our nursing, graduate school, medicine, and of course all of our health professions programs, and be able to be exposed to all of the different programs that we have, and hopefully then be able to have a career goal that relates to, and obviously we would love to have them come to Upstate, but something that relates to healthcare.
So then how did this whole program gets started. It hasn't actually begun. You've just won an award to get it started. So tell us about the background.
Sure. So SUNY had offered a diversity and academic excellence grant for $10,000. Myself in multicultural and student affairs with folks in admissions decided to get together and say, what can we do to, you know, expose students early on? And hopefully, again, our goal, obviously, in some ways, is to increase our student population here at Upstate in one of our health programs or our medicine program or graduate school or nursing. So we wanted to write a grant to reach out to other students at other SUNY schools. And one of the things that SUNY had said in their application was, you know, if you can do something collaborating among SUNYs, you know, which is easy to do because so many students from New York State go to a SUNY school and hopefully will stay on and come to an upper level program with us.
And SUNY, for those who may not know, is the State University of New York, which is the overarching organization that basically manages all of the university
programs. And there's 64 colleges through SUNY.
Right.
And some of them are natural feeders for us. Our physical therapy program, we have a program where they start out at Geneseo and they come to us. We have other programs like that with other colleges. But there are some colleges where maybe we aren't getting students, or maybe they're not even realizing they could be from Syracuse and they don't even know what a cardiovascular perfusion is, you know, a student is. So they wouldn't even know that we would have that major.
That kind of programming.
Yeah.
But the idea here is it's not just to attract the general population.
Right.
You're really looking for those underrepresented
Correct.
And diverse populations.
Correct.
So you won a grant. You won
yeah.
the $10,000
yep.
grant. Wow. And so exactly how is it going to work? And what do you need to do to get this program underway?
Sure. So we have picked the week. It's the first week. I remember the date, but the first week is like May 31st is the week for next year. So we have between now and the end of May to actually go through the whole process.
So 2015, it will actually begin.
Yep, they'll arrive on campus.
If you're just
May
joining 15th. Us, by the way, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Sharon Heward. She's the Associate Dean of Student and Multicultural Affairs at Upstate Medical University, and we're talking about a program to basically introduce underserved populations to the possibility of a life as a healthcare provider. So go ahead.
Sure. So what we'll do now, starting in September, is we will be going through our admissions team, we'll be going to all of the different SUNY schools and meeting with health career advisors, meeting with their different advisors to talk about our program, giving them information and talking to them about the types of students that we want to hope to attract to apply. That will happen throughout our whole cycle, which is pretty much the fall where we're doing all of our advertising anyway and meeting with different SUNYs. And then we will have students from these different programs be able to apply, and we'll let them know, yes, we'll accept you. We're going to accept 25 students. They'll arrive here that last week in May, starting in June, right when they get out of college, and we'll have them live right in our brand new residence tower, Geneva Tower. We will have them throughout the week do all kinds of activities with our four different colleges.
So what kinds of things? I saw somewhere that you're going to have lectures, demonstrations, some simulations.
Yeah.
What exactly, I mean, will they have any hands-on opportunities?
Yeah. So we have a MedQuest program that you might have heard about that we bring high school students through our admissions office. And we are taking some of that program because it's been so successful, some of the different hands-on things that they have done. They were able to see the helicopter land. They were able to go to the simulation center. They were able to have lunch with a panel of nurses. So we're taking some of the
same
bigger
concepts.
Pieces from that. The other part that we're doing, though, because the high school program is really just like a quick exposure, and where this is, we really know these students have at least identified that they want to do something in the health career.
So in a way, it's a self-selected group. It's a group that's already indicated some interest,
Correct.
What you call pre-health.
Right.
What kind of courses would they be taking
it
to be in pre-health?
Taking biology, you know.
So the sciences.
Some science course, and they know they want to do something. And they may be thinking, I want to be a doctor. But they may not realize that there's several other health careers. Or they may be thinking nurse, because that's the first thing that comes to mind when they think of a health career. And again, there's a lot of our programs and health professions that students don't know about, and people don't think about the research side all the time, and we have PhD and graduate programs here. So they'll be hearing from all of our programs and meeting with some of our students. And what we want is to expose them to the health grid, but we also selfishly want them to come here. So we want to make that connection with our students and with our admissions staff.
But the idea here is that you're really trying to attract a diverse group of students mm-hmm. to both enrich the educational community in the upstate campus,
sure.
but also to then basically inspire these kids to find some life in a health care provider role.
Right. Hopefully in upstate New York
and
or
stay,
in New York State, yeah.
And
yeah.
remain perhaps in the New York State system.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Are there other programs like this that you know of in the country?
There are some programs that are specific to medical and dental. I don't know all the details, but they have a much longer. Ours is a 1 week program, and they may be between like their junior and senior year. That's like a 4 or 6 week program.
Okay, with the same goal in mind.
Then. Probably with the same goal in mind, but maybe a little different process where they're revving them up, giving them some extra education, maybe some more biology classes or some anatomy or something like that to kind of get them where they need to go for school. Where ours is really kind of still the exploration stage, which is why we're targeting students who have finished their first or second year of college.
Would there be some opportunity if somebody came through your program to have another opportunity to return to the upstate campus? Is that something you've thought about?
You know what?
In terms of a follow-up?
I think it would probably, well, so for I always thought you meant for a return the second year, but as far as following up with us, that's the other thing that I think is unique about our program. We will have them each assigned to an admissions advisor so that when they go back to their campus through the rest of their career, and it doesn't matter so much if they're coming here, but we've agreed that we'll continue to advise them
and mentor them in some way.
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
What kind of, just in the little bit of time we have left, what careers specifically would people be exposed to? Obviously, medicine and nursing being
yeah.
two most prominent.
Yeah.
Give us a smattering.
We have respiratory therapy here. We have physical therapy, which is a very popular program. We have MPH, Masters in Public Health, which people may or may not have ever heard about. We have a new PA program here at Upstate.
Physician Assistant
yeah.
Program.
Yeah, and I think people may not even know Upstate has that program. And then there's other programs like cardiovascular perfusion that people may not even know what that person does or have heard of that career. And then all of the sonography and imaging and so on. So there's a lot of excellent programs.
Yeah. A lot of technical mm-hmm. types. If you're a technical kind of person,
absolutely.
A lot of technical
yeah.
kinds of things
yeah.
to learn as well.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Sharon, so much
yeah.
for coming in and sharing all this with us. My guest has been Sharon Heward, the Associate Dean of Student and Multicultural Affairs at Upstate Medical University. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. And now, Deirdre Nealon, editor of Upstate Medical University's literary and visual arts journal, The Healing Muse, with this week's selection.
Thank you, Linda. The Americans with Disabilities Act was passed by Congress in 1990. It is justly celebrated for opening the doors to schools, jobs, housing, transportation opportunities for those who have physical or mental disabilities. Sometimes the ADA seems like a monolith. And it's quite instructive when we read something that reminds us we are talking about people. Jack Turin sent us a poignant memoir about his son. I would like to read an excerpt from his essay, Greggy. On September 17, 1980, my son Gregory Mark Turin died. He was 17. The usual outpourings of sympathy after such an event were somewhat muted. A few close friends commiserated deeply and sincerely, but others were more restrained. Some stated openly what they thought, while others implied it. The thought was always the same. How can any parent mourn the death of a severely handicapped child, a child with nothing to look forward to? They should be glad it's all over. Greggy was born severely mentally disabled. He also had cerebral palsy. He spent most of his life in a wheelchair. During the last 5 years of his life, he was almost completely immobile. The only parts of his body he could move were his toes and wrists. All the natural functions of life that others accomplished automatically had to be done for him. Yet watching this child struggle to gain satisfaction, saluting each day with wide-eyed wonder at what was to come, drinking in and enjoying the tiny portion of life that was allotted to him, gave us a reward that can't be measured in normal human terms. Taking care of Greggy was a 24-hour-a-day job. He was a very demanding child because the only means he had of controlling his life was his voice, which he used constantly. He learned to baby talk when he was 5 and baby talked for the rest of his life. During all that time, we never heard from that baby talk one word of self-pity or bewailing his fate. What we did hear were demands to see, do, go. Greggy wanted to see everything, go every place, learn everything he could. His world was restricted to a far smaller portion than that given to most people, but that tiny share of life was a constantly unfolding vista of wonderment for him. As I sat struggling with my grief, many questions came to me. One of them was, what would Greggy do in a situation like this if one or both of us had died before him? He would have missed us deeply, but he would not have buried himself in a morass of self-pity. He would have continued to use whatever limited ability he possessed to develop, to learn, to drink his tiny cup of life to the fullest. To honor Greggy's memory, I decided to do what he would have done, study, learn, teach, use my life in the best way possible. Over the years, when I looked into the eyes of some of my students and saw a look of magical curiosity or a sparkling sense of humor, a strange thrill went through me. I knew for that one heavenly suspended second, I had looked again into the eyes of Greggy.
Thank you for joining us for Upstate's HealthLink on Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Join us again next week when we explore how one woman's quest for fitness is making her an iron woman. And we examine the changing face of orthopedics with the president of the American Board of Orthopedic Surgery. If you'd like to listen again to tonight's show, you can find a podcast of it on our website, healthlinkonair.org. And to keep up with all the goings-on at Upstate, check out the What's Up at Upstate blog at upstate.edu/whatsup. HealthLink on Air is directed by Amber Smith and Becky Serio and produced by Steve Marks, with sound engineers John Miller and Gerard Roy. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.